All right, and welcome to DPIY, the podcast where, DIY is not exactly what we're good at, but it is how we make our podcast. I am the Senseless Apprentice, and with me is my co-host, Mr. Verano.
How's it going, everybody?
And we have moved into a time where we sort of have a more standard format. So we're going to start with opening discussion. We're going to move on to an issue of Cable and Deadpool, and then we're going to talk about our five takeaways from the War of the Bounty Hunters and related Star Wars titles in current Marvel comics. Obi-Wan has come out, and just kind of while it's still coming out, we thought, why not take a look at some of the other Star Wars related properties that are out there as well. But before all that begins, or before all that happens, we are going to begin with it by talking about a few things related to comics in the current moment. And the first one has nothing to do with comics.
Okay, I was going to say my first one will because I did see the trailer for Black Adam.
Oh, yeah, and I did not. That's my
It's
fault.
awesome. You are missing out. You will find it on YouTube really easily. I just saw it again while I was watching an episode of MLW for anyone listening. That's Major League Wrestling, probably about the fifth big promotion of wrestling in, around the US. Yeah, literally the trailer came out and I'm like, oh, I just saw that last night. Freaking awesome.
I will see. I think I only just read about it recently, so I don't know. I'm excited to see the JSA. Their Hawkman looks good, and of course, The Rock is going to play an excellent Black Adam.
They also had the Atom Smasher in the trailer.
Yeah, and now all the shit on Instagram is like, oh, his mask looks like Deadpool's. And it's like, really, a full face mask looks very similar to another full face mask, just different colors. Wow, you people are very observant.
Yeah, they are. But yeah, it looks great. It's yeah, I think it's going to be one of those new better movies, one of those new kind of classic movies. But with that one, yeah, I saw that trailer because I actually watched Jurassic Park 3, which
Oh
is
yeah, you
really not see 2 at all. I
To be
was wondering.
fair, that one doesn't really is not as related to comic books though.
No, it's not at all. But I it was a good movie, minus two scenes that literally had me a little stumped as to what the hell.
A lot of that in certain movies.
Oh yeah. Doctor Strange, we both finally saw it. I know I did.
Yes, and I thought it was a good. It was interesting. They went the horror comic route, so that was cool. And I did like it. I did like the, Scarlet Witch disassembled and all the things that they did. I was underwhelmed by the cameos.
I was, but the one true entrance I enjoyed was Dr. Xavier. I thought that was like hell to the yes.
I mean, I know, but they had, with all the rumors leading up, they had so much potential. And then, like, there was the leaked one that was, Professor X. There was the fan cast one. There were the two logical ones. The fan cast, if you haven't seen it, spoilers, skip the next, minute and a half, 2 minutes. But the fan cast one is John Krasinski as Mr. Fantastic. Then you have, I forget her name, but she was the
Marvel,
well, the Captain Marvel, but
Captain
it was the
Remington.
mom. It was Miss Rambo, not the Rambo we see in WandaVision. I forget her name. Lashana Lynch, I think. And so like that was pretty, okay, so it's a what if. So what if the other person was Captain Marvel? Cool, we got that. And then you had Captain Carter. But then the only other really big cameo was,
Black Bolt.
yeah, they had Anson Mount, who I've loved since Pool Hall Junkies, but They had Anson Mount confirming that somewhere in the multiverse Inhumans is canon, and I just sat there thinking, you had two versions of Ghost Rider on the table. You didn't even have to use it in the Illuminati scenes. Ghost Rider would not be Illuminati, but you're going horror comic route. There was a scene where there was clearly an opening to a Brimstone dimension. Like, you're telling me you can't have the chain snap around her ankle like he's trying to crawl out of hell? Like, I was...
No, this time around, they weren't going to do it. I'm sorry. Full disappointment to you.
But my thing is just, like, you had two versions of Ghost Rider on the table, and you connect a show that, like, 10 people besides myself watched. I watched that show.
I did too. I actually liked it. It was a shame. Like, it really got bad ratings and not anything else given towards it, because I thought, like, they really tried to really pull it all together.
Well, yeah, except for I was off as soon as they cut Medusa's hair.
Yeah, I was going to say, minus cutting Medusa's hair, that was a mess up.
I mean, her whole thing is her hair, and they're like, we can't animate that. Just cut it off. But I mean, that was I will say the Clea cameo at the end is really cool, and Bruce Campbell, I love that tongue in cheek shit at the end. You still there?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
But yeah. So all right, give it a, you know, we do our arbitrary grading system. Give it a letter grade. What would you give Doctor Strange?
I'd still give it a solid B.
I guess we agree. I'd give it a B. Watch it. Have fun. Don't bring the kids. They'll probably be scared. But oh, dude.
Scare the hell out of them. You might actually be them.
Well, that's your choice. So the next thing after, you know, we give it a B and all that and go see it. The Thor trailer also came out recently, along with that Black Adam trailer too. A couple of demigods, you know.
Yeah, I was good until Natalie Portman. They didn't care.
Oh no! See, I'm really cool with it. I just find it funny that there's all these memes that are like, "Oh, look at the direction Marvel's going," and comparing character by character the Avengers without ever looking into the fact, like, what they're clearly trying to do. You know, so like with Natalie Portman as Jane Foster, coming up when Thor comes out, I've been reading a bunch of Thor comics so that we can do five takeaways from Thor, particularly the Gore the God Butcher storyline. But one of the ones I've been reading is Mighty Thor. And I got to say, if they go with the source material, Jane Foster Thor has a expiration date.
Does that mean she dies?
So, Jane Foster Thor in the comics has metastatic cancer.
Yes.
And every time she picks up the hammer, the thing about it is, the unique thing about cancer is the way it's structured, it's not like a disease you catch. It's genetic. It's genes failing. And so technically, cancer is a naturally occurring phenomenon. But the chemotherapy that she uses to fight the cancer is not. So whenever she picks up the hammer, it cleans her body of all toxins, which means it kills the chemo. But the cancer keeps going because the cancer is natural. So, like, there's all in the Mighty Thor, the thing is, there's all these things that she, like, she just feels she has to do to protect the 10 realms. But in doing so, she's bringing on her own demise faster because she's basically wiping out anything that's helping her fight the cancer. Which, you know, so people constantly complain and about, like, oh, this is the direction they're going with Thor. They're going to replace Chris Hemsworth with Natalie Portman. They're not. If they follow the source material, she'll probably, you know, die. But, and the twist in the comics was, she died, and then, you know, went to the war on her dead, and, you know, became another version of Valkyrie. You know, she goes to Valhalla.
Well, she should.
But speaking of that, what'd you think of the Thor trailer?
I think it's good. Like I said, unfortunately to see Natalie Portman, I was like, great, her. But no, I think overall the fight scenes and kind of where the story's supposed to lead to should be really good. And yeah, it's got some of my favorite characters in there, which is the Valkyrie and Thor.
So the big there's a couple of Easter eggs. The first one is that there's a scene where he's in a hall with a bunch of statues, and you kind of see representations of death and eternity, and I want to say Eon, or I can't remember what the all of them are, but you know, that gives us some hints at more of the cosmic type characters that are in play in the MCU. But the other big Easter egg was a scene with Zeus where Thor gets stripped down, and there's a Loki tattoo on his back. And so I wanted to get your prediction. What chance do you think Thor, like, they continue with this whole everybody's finding out about the multiverse, Thor finds out that Loki, and particularly Lady Loki, broke the sacred timeline?
I'd say probably 10%.
Yeah, that's about the going rate for any of my predictions. About 10% are right. I just talk like I know what I'm talking about.
You're doing well.
So on that front, there was another news story we read where the Deadpool 3 writers have said that Disney has been supportive of their R-rated elements. Yes. But first off, I just want to caution listeners, a lot can happen between writing a script and the final cut of a movie. It was clear that the first Venom was supposed to be R-rated when fucking Riot literally cuts a room in half and then there's no blood, so it's PG-13. You know, but
a lot of time can happen between recording it and editing the whole thing. It's a shame.
So I like just basically wanted to talk about predictions regarding if or when another Deadpool movie would be released, because, like, to be honest, when we started this podcast, part of it was the Deadpool 2 was still pretty popular, pretty fresh in people's minds, and it was like, all right, you know, by the time they release 3, we'll have some content out there and people will catch on. You know, we might, and you know, the early stuff is rough, so if you've gotten to this point, you had to listen to through a lot of crap. But you know, the whole point was that we'd hit the algorithm around the time when Deadpool 3 was being released and people were looking into the topic more, and then, like, apparently they're still script writing. I still think that when Disney signed Ryan Reynolds to that massive contract that was reported on, it was a tease, and they're going to throw him into all the non-Deadpool movies they can to not have to release a Deadpool movie. But that's my prediction. What do you think?
You could be right, but I would hope that they can finally actually do the third one, because I honestly think a lot of people are supportive of it. A lot of people like it, and he's a great actor. He makes it funny. Like, that really is his role.
Yeah.
To not do it would be, I don't know, you'd really just be pissing off the rest of the world. Like, you know, for once, finally, give the people what they want. They want to see one more movie.
At least one.
And but if I do cameos on the rest of them, that's fine.
Yeah. I do think that that he probably will make a So another thing that was released, and I want to get back to that topic because there's one more thing with regards to our connection to Deadpool that I want to talk about, but they recently released that they're making a Thunderbolts movie, which tells us exactly what we had already said a couple of episodes ago when we were talking about how Marvel is clearly building various teams. You know, Ms. Marvel's out now, and that's probably good. Leading towards Young Avengers. Yeah.
Marvel's great, actually.
Yeah, so I mean, only the first episode, but that's out now, and And that's clearly part of what's building towards the Young Avengers. That's where Hawkeye's probably going. They've introduced Eli Bradley. Wiccan and Speed are out there in the multiverse somewhere, as we saw in Doctor Strange, because that was an actual alternate reality, you know. And, you know, there's so many other, I mean, we've already seen Cassie Lang, so Stature's there. Like, there's so many Young Avengers out there to be pulled together into a team. And then, you know, they were clearly building something with Allegra, the Contessa. And, you know, they just announced with that one that they're built, that there's a Thunderbolts thing in the works. And, you know, US Agent, Yelena Belova, they're already there. Ghost is already out there. A few different characters that can be brought in. Baron Zemo's out there. He was one of the leaders. But there's been hints of Deadpool in that, and I think if they're going to do that, the best thing that they could do is there's a couple of comics. There's a Deadpool where he tries to join the X-Men thing, and that could be a way to bring in the X-Men, but where he goes up against Norman Osborn as the leader of the Thunderbolts, and then there's also just a Deadpool versus the Thunderbolts story. So those could be cool.
Yeah, be very good possibilities, and I'm really hoping it can go one of those ways.
So the one thing I wanted to get back to with how we kind of modeled our podcast after, you know, the connecting to the Deadpool movie and using the Cable and Deadpool story comics, because that was one of the first Deadpool comics that I read, and they were really fun when I read them and I wanted to share them with the world. But part of that was that we made up nicknames connected to the characters, you know, Cable and Deadpool, Senseless Apprentice, and then, you know, Mr. Verano, connecting to, you know, if you haven't made the connection yet, Verano is Spanish for summer, and Cable's name is Nathan Christopher Summers. But part of the nicknames was we wanted to be free to be sort of a little bit R-rated with our language and stuff like that, just like the movies. And, you know, I was in a career where I didn't want certain people to connect it to me. And that was a little bit of hubris, because in order for people to connect it, we need to have more than, you know, 10 listeners. So, and please, I realized that, like,
please still pass the word along. I think we're at this now. So this is getting better from a year ago when we had one.
So the thing was, I also have been listening to other podcasts where people just use their first names. And I was like, you know what? You can clearly tell my nickname comes from, you know, Nirvana's In Utero album, the line from Scentless Apprentice, where he says he was born scentless and senseless. He was born a scentless apprentice, you know. It was just kind of a tongue-in-cheek. I've been listening to Nirvana at the time. I have gotten tired of my nickname. So, you know, you can find out Verano's name in past episodes where I fucked up. But he's going to keep going by Verano. But for the time being, hi.
Still love it.
For the time being, hi. I'm going to be Jake. So, you know, now it's going to be DPIY with Jake and Mr. Verano. So that's just that. And with that, we can finally get into Cable and Deadpool issue 27. This is the Blood of Apocalypse prequel. Blood of Apocalypse is a storyline in X-Men, so it's a prequel for a completely different title. And this one is Born Again Part 2 With Eyes Open. It's written by Fabian Nicieza, pencils by Lan Medina, inks by Ed Tadeo, colors by Gotham. I love that the entire city that is home to Batman is helping out Marvel Comics. And then the letters are by VC's Corey Petit. And I know he probably goes by Pettit, but I'm going to say Petit because it's the one place.
He sounds like a fancy French guy.
Exactly. And who doesn't want to be a fancy French guy, but most people. Anyway, the recap page is once again Deadpool and Apocalypse, but this time They're facing the same way, and it's kind of like a continuation of the last recap page, but this time, Apocalypse knows a little more of what's going on, although this doesn't make him any less one-dimensional of a character. Apocalypse has little to say outside of general platitudes about the strong surviving, because he is the personification of Darwinism taken to the extreme.
This leaves the task of telling the story too far to Deadpool.
That was a misprint. It should have said so far. Sorry.
Apocalypse's right hand has been planning the resurrection of Apocalypse. Cable has been following Ozymandias. Deadpool and Irene Merriweather tailing Cable. They all end up in Aqaba, Egypt, where Deadpool and Irene are accosted by the Dark Rider, a group of warriors loyal to Apocalypse, who bow to Cable when he emerges from the floating Sphinx inside a larger Sphinx, both of which have Apocalypse's face, which must be mortifying more than the real Sphinx we have now.
Well, but it's drawn in comic book style, so it doesn't look as scary as it's supposed to. There's also a lot of blood in this that looks...
I'm sure it's still scary. It's Apocalypse's face, after all.
No, but what I mean is, it's the way it's drawn is so... I don't know how to describe it. Bright colors, lighthearted. Like, it's drawn in such a way where, like, the impact of some of the more gruesome elements of this story don't really land. Like, there's entire pools of, like, blood fountains in this, and it's just kind of like, hey, that looks like a fountain with red coloring dye. Not really, like, what's supposed to be gruesome isn't as gruesome as it could be, I guess.
Gotcha.
Meanwhile, in the B plot, we were treated to times in the ancient past where Cable, known to Apocalypse, Ozymandias, and the Dark Riders as the Traveler, confronted Apocalypse and gave him an initial taste of the celestial technology with which he would eventually, you know, merge. This happens in an early scene where Apocalypse, in his human form, you know, no blue lips, no celestial whatever, cuts off Cable's techno-organic arm in a sword battle. Although Cable was using a battle axe at the time, like a sword. Cable responds by shooting Apocalypse in his head and apparently killing him, except they make sure to note the silver blood from Cable's arm mixing in with the red blood from Apocalypse's head. Oz has taken Apocalypse's body to the celestial ship where they had found in their conquering travels, which is located in some unnamed mountain in ancient China, in the hope that it can do something to bring his master back.
And of course it... Well, let's keep going. Our issue opens with Cable and Ozymandias standing outside of that ship. We know that is definitely Cable's past because he is sporting a magnificently long brown mullet pulled back into a ponytail that is floating like a whip over his shoulder in the mountain wind instead of gray flat top he is more known for. He's really pulling that 80s look. Yeah, it's super unfortunate. Over his shoulder, his metal one, rests a two-headed battle axe that is roughly the size of Cable's torso. It must be hard to swing that damn head.
Ozymandias, by comparison, looks like a skinny puny man, but made of stone.
So he looks like Cheeseburger, the wrestler from Ring of Honor.
more along the lines of like comparative. I mean, I hate to throw shade and bury someone. I actually think he was probably pretty good, but more along the lines of Marco Stunt.
But is he that short to Marco?
I don't know. He looks small compared to everybody, and like. Ozymandias, for someone who's supposed to have some kind of ancient power, looks weak in every scene he's in this. So,
all right. Ozymandias calmly explains to Cable the reason he's brought Apocalypse to the ship, hoping for a resurrection, though he can't help but know that though it has been many years since Cable shot Apocalypse in the head, Cable hasn't changed a bit.
Cable, meanwhile, simply doesn't have time for this shit and runs straight up to the wall of the ship, which it is hinted through the narrative is the same ship that will eventually become Cable's island nation of Providence. Like, basically, it shows up as Apocalypse's ship in the 80s, and then Cable takes it over, and then it becomes Magneto's or something, and then blah, blah, blah. It's gone through a whole bunch of different iterations before becoming Providence. So, but at this point, it's the celestial ship that is Apocalypse's, because he took it from the mountains of China or something like that. Anyway, he cuts his way in through the side with his massive battle axe, which makes me feel very comfortable about, you know, its ability to travel in space.
Yeah. It's completely dark inside, so Cable makes his way through a room glowing with blue tinted light. This room, he finds a decrepit Apocalypse. There are tubes and wires attached to all of the available skin space except for Apocalypse's shoulders and head, which has a blue armor reminiscent of the 90s form. The skin of Apocalypse's face is gray and chapped, but the blue lips he is known for are beginning to take form. He still notices he bears the scars of being shot in the forehead in space right above his eye.
Apocalypse thanks Cable for the gift of his blood, which allowed Apocalypse to talk to the ship and learn its secrets. So, like, he's saying, like, you know, thank you for shooting me in the head, and after I'd cut your arm off and our blood mixed, and then, you know, Ozymandias brought me here, and that blood is what enabled me to come back to life, basically. And then he attacks Cable with the help of the ship, because, of course, he's still, you know, attached to all these tubes and becoming stronger or whatever. A lot of what is established here reminds me of two different Apocalypse-related titles. One is the Deathseed storyline in the alternate universe Age of Apocalypse title that came out in 2012, which it reminds me of that because in this, Apocalypse keeps coming back, and with the twist at the end that we're going to talk about, like, it kind of plays into that storyline, where in the Age of Apocalypse, Magneto is supposed to have killed Apocalypse, so in that one, someone basically has to be Apocalypse. According to the Celestials, they need an agent of sort of destruction that Apocalypse represents. So Wolverine, or that universe's Weapon X, takes on the Death Seed and becomes the next Apocalypse, and that's who they're fighting in that alternate universe. The other one is the X-Factor storyline from the late 80s, where Apocalypse infected Cable with a techno-organic virus that makes this resurrection possible in the first place. So there's a whole big full circle here, where Apocalypse gave Cable the virus that made Apocalypse able to talk to the ship in the past, and blah, blah. It's a fucking spiral that we're going to keep talking about and referencing as we go through this.
Yes, we are. Cable dodges Apocalypse attack, and a spike that looks like a cross between a headphone jack and Wolverine's metal claws emerges from the back of his hand. He tells Apocalypse that he also has the ability to talk to his ship, which is pretty much implied when Apocalypse thanked Cable, you know, in the first place.
Meanwhile, in the A-plot, Deadpool and Irene can't believe Cable just said he wants Apocalypse to be resurrected. Cable replies to their disbelief with the cryptic statement that if Apocalypse resurrects now, then Cable is sure he can save the world. Irene is still skeptical, but Deadpool figures Cable is probably right, because this type of cryptic shit is the norm for Cable.
Cable and Ozymandias go back inside the spaceship with Deadpool following. This leaves Irene standing outside alone with the Dark Riders, so she runs in to catch up. Inside the vast chamber with an ornate, asymmetrical, three-level pool of blood that's with interconnected blood walls and spouts. This is kind of reminding me, like, the movie, I don't know why, of Chronicles of Riddick. weird things, except this one has blood spouts. Glyphs on the fountain depict Apocalypse being worshipped by followers. Deadpool has a description of the room as well.
Wow! It's like Willy Wonka. Well, if Wonka were Dracula and the chocolate factory was an abattoir. Irene, meanwhile, confronts Cable about the last time Apocalypse was in the comics, which was an X-Men story from about 5 years before this called The 12. That was where Apocalypse gathers set different sets of mutants who represent like certain things. Like he gathers Storm because she represents weather. She gathers Cyclops and Jean Grey and Cable to represent like family, father, son, and or father, mother, and son. And it's also where Wolverine gets his adamantium back, because Apocalypse basically kidnaps Wolverine and Sabretooth and says, one of you will become my agent of death, and whoever does gets the adamantium on Sabretooth's bones. And so Wolverine was like, you know, I don't want to be working for Apocalypse. I don't want to be brainwashed by him, but Creed won't even try to fight it. At least I will try to fight it, and I will get away from it. So he beats Sabretooth and gets the adamantium and comes back as Apocalypse's Horseman of Death in that storyline. That one ends with Cyclops first merging with Apocalypse, like basically getting in the way and ruining Apocalypse's plan, and they become two people in one body. And then there's a storyline from a few months later where Cyclops or Cable and Jean Grey feel horrible about the way it ended, and they go and they search for Cyclops and find him and Apocalypse merged, and then Cable splits them up and basically grants Cyclops the body by scattering Apocalypse's essence. So as of that point, Apocalypse is essentially considered to be dead. You know, he doesn't have a body because his body goes to Cyclops, and Apocalypse is just, his essence was scattered to and destroyed. Basically, Cable was supposed to have destroyed his soul. But, you know, now we're retconning. So, strap in.
Okay. That story concluded with Cyclops seeming to sacrifice himself to merge with Apocalypse. A few months later, we see from the story from Cable and Jean Grey for their merged Apocalypse and Cyclops being. Cable is then able to save his father by telepathically splitting their souls and scattered Apocalypse, giving Scott Summers full control of the body.
Cable and Ozymandias take turns explaining that thanks to Cable and his super sweet cyborg blood from his techno-organic side. Take turns explaining that thanks to Cable and his super sweet cyborg blood from his techno-organic side, as long as a single drop of Apocalypse's blood remains, he can always be fully resurrected. Kind of like a Marvel Comics version of Cell, except super unbeatable because there's no Goku and Gohan to pull off a sweet father-son Kamehameha.
Which would be cool, but unfortunately I really hate Cyclops. So I don't want to see that happen.
I mean, there's Cable and Cyclops, but they don't know how to do a Kamehameha.
Yeah, Cyclops would ruin that. He'd really be gone.
He'd do it from his eyes.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back in the past, Cable jams a telephone jackknife into a hole in the wall as Apocalypse looks on with surprised curiosity. The ship begins to launch as Cable body slides by one to where Ozymandias is standing in shock.
As the ship disappears, Cable remarks to himself that it's all his fault. He came back to learn about how to kill Apocalypse once and for all, and ironically became the MacGuffin that made him functionally immortal. In a weird way, this means Apocalypse made himself immortal, since he was the one who infected Nathan Christopher Summers, the baby, with the techno-organic virus just to fuck with Mr. Sinister's genetic engineering in the first place. Like, in that storyline, it was all just, okay, Sinister's, like, been manipulating these two people. I'm going to limit what he's done because I can, because fuck Mr. Sinister, even though he's my, you know, subordinate. Like, he was doing it to fuck with Mr. Sinister's shit and functionally made himself immortal.
Yeah, he really made it work in his favor. Ozymandias asks Cable if his master will be returning, to which Cable replies, no, Apocalypse will.
Back in modern-day Aqaba, Deadpool leaps to the edge of a blood-filled basin, saying he might as well shoot Apocalypse now before he wakes up. A cross between the decrepit Apocalypse we saw before and the Crypt Keeper from Tales of the Crypt grabs Deadpool from behind while criticizing Cable for aligning himself with lesser and lesser beings after every resurrection.
Deadpool shoots Apocalypse off with a pistol as Ozymandias begs Apocalypse to rise and kick everyone's ass because the Dark Rider still answered a cable and sees the most recently defeated Apocalypse. As Deadpool fights the Allegiance, torn Dark Rider, Cable places Irene a protective gravimetric shell as Apocalypse looks on. He immediately understands that in his time period, Cable has lost his power and has created technology-based substitutes.
Cable runs at Apocalypse and gives him a metal-armed haymaker to the gut with enough power to literally push him through a wall. Like, he basically, Apocalypse is like, oh, you've lost your powers, and is kind of like saying he's better off than Cable or whatever. And Cable's like, no, I can still kick your ass. So Deadpool, meanwhile, is cutting a Dark Rider in half and complaining that they don't scream like normal people. Irene, meanwhile, points out to Ozymandias, who is useless in a fight even though he's made of stone, that Cable could have stopped the resurrection at any time, since it's not like the Dark Riders or Ozymandias could stop him. Like, he could basically just destroy, know wherever Apocalypse was, follow Ozymandias and destroy him, because that's exactly what he did, except for not destroying Apocalypse.
Apocalypse is more interested in why Cable isn't killing him now while he has a chance. Cable tells him that the mutants need something dramatic and urgent like Apocalypse to bring them together, since the Scarlet Witch destroyed the mutant race on M-Day.
Apocalypse seems willing to take on this role, which leads to his actions in X-Men Blood of Apocalypse storyline, which is mostly notable for the image of Gambit in his photo-negative form as the Horseman of Death. Like, if you look up, like, go online and look up Gambit and on Google, this is the one where he's got white hair, black skin, like jet black, not like, you know, blackface, like just straight, like still has the red eyes though. And he's the Horseman of Death. It also brings back Sunfire, who had his legs cut off before that by Lady Deathstrike, and then his powers taken by Rogue. And in this case, he looks like his Age of Apocalypse form, like a bone mask with a Japanese sun in the middle of the forehead, and like looks like a nuclear reactor is his body. Like, he's just a burning ember. It's pretty cool. But that's the Horseman of Famine. There's some random person, I think his name is Gazer, is the Horseman of War. And then a repowered Polaris as the Horseman of Pestilence.
Ooh, very creepy.
Yeah.
Especially Pestilence, oh gosh. Meanwhile, in our title story, Apocalypse tells Cable that regardless of his success or failure in the Blood of Apocalypse, he can always just resurrect to take over the world another day. Cable says he does not need to physically stop Apocalypse, just the extremist version of the Darwinism that Apocalypse represents. He uses his headphone jackknife to cut off his human hand and states...
Not cut it off, just cut it.
Oh, my bad. Cut his hand, human hand, and states, with this blood, I can make everyone fit, make everyone strong, and eventually you will simply cease to matter.
Because why give up a good Jesus metaphor? I mean, fuck, that's just communion. Yeah. As Cable, Irene, and Deadpool walk out of the temple, Irene shows she has not really comprehended the implications of what just happened in front of her face when she confronts Cable for being too macho. She tells Cable that because he didn't stop Apocalypse here, whoever he kills in the future will be on Cable's back.
Cable tells Irene that it's deeper than that, because he is ultimately responsible for Apocalypse's functional immortality. Everyone that Apocalypse has ever killed after Cable shot him in the head is on his back. As he walks forward symbolically into the shadow, Cable tells Irene and Deadpool that this is the reason Cable keeps facing forward.
Back in the Sphinx, Ozymandias helps Apocalypse into a secondary regeneration chamber, uselessly reminding his master that humanity doesn't need a culling this time. And I say uselessly because in Blood of Apocalypse, part of Apocalypse's plan involves culling humanity. Of course. Why change stripes? But Ozymandias is trying to... They don't need a culling. They need a... You know, Apocalypse listens about as well as Irene. Fuck us, right? As he turns away from the chamber, laments how Cable is always one step ahead of them.
Weeks later, in the Mana Bar in Mexico City, a generic mercenary type figure is showing G.W. Bridge and Domino pictures of Deadpool's involvement in political chaos that has erupted in the fictional country of Rumekistan. This person is looking to hire the six-pack to stop the instability. According to Domino, the group will jump at the chance to nail Deadpool and Cable. But that won't happen until the next issue.
All right. So some of the things we like to talk about before we move into our five takeaways. First off, favorite art. What was your favorite art of this issue?
Would actually be like walking in and unfortunately seeing the levels of blood in the ship.
That was an interesting thing. That one didn't land with me though, because it was just like, this is supposed to be like horror movie-esque, and these fountains look just really nice.
Yeah. Still kind of got me. I was like, what the hell?
I like the scene, like when there's this two panel set in the scene transition after Cable sends Apocalypse's ship into space. It's two pictures of Cable walking away from Ozymandias. First one is him walking away after sending the ship into space. So it's his young form, the Traveler. Ozymandias isn't stone just yet. He's just a old man. And then the other one is Cable's older form in the modern day, as he's walking into the ship, and Ozymandias is in the same position watching him walk away, but he's stone. And it just sort of shows you some of the physical ways that both characters have changed in the past and from the past to the present, and in some of the mannerisms that they have that have stayed the same. You know, like Ozymandias is always sort of that person watching from behind. He's the chronicler. He's not the one making the history. He's the one watching it being made. Cable is sort of the opposite. So it's wonderfully subtle, and I fucking love it.
All right. Very good. All right, that was only about the art, right? And that's not about your favorite part of the story.
No. My favorite part of the story is actually... it's kind of the... There's two reasons for this. My favorite part of the story is the final scene transition into the next story. Because I know what's coming and the interesting tie that it has to the Falcon and the Winter Soldier show. Like, basically in the next story, we're going to see a character come up that is related to Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I don't want to spoil it too much just yet, so I'm not gonna tell you too much. But yeah, it's nice. I also respect this story, but I don't really want to pick a scene from it to be my favorite. I don't really like this retcon. I feel like it makes a lot of Cable content from the 1990s, which was when I started reading comics, when I started picking them up. And I feel like and Cable was one of my favorite characters then, and I feel it just makes a lot of it irrelevant. He spends a lot of that time almost fanatically obsessed with killing Apocalypse, and this story establishes that he always knew he couldn't actually kill Apocalypse, because part of his first appearances, when they finally reveal that Cyclops is his father, is kind of like how he's older than his dad, you know? So since this canonically establishes it was a young man that, you know, made Apocalypse functionally immortal, like it kind of through timeline and through an implication just makes a lot of my favorite shit completely irrelevant.
Gotcha. For me, yeah, I would have to kind of say the last scene. Just, I mean, to me, it's always funny when someone's really wanting to go after Deadpool.
Yeah, that's going to be...
It's nice. It's just always funny when you just hear characters being like, oh yeah, definitely going after that guy.
It's what's coming up eventually is going to make... there's a lot of fun stuff on the Deadpool side coming up. I think.
Heck yeah. All right. Favorite character?
I guess Cable. No one really looks good in this story. Ozymandias is a useless chunk of stone. Apocalypse is his usual one-dimensional self. Deadpool is kind of a lapdog. Irene is the most clueless reporter who ever lived. At least Cable in this story is accepting his responsibility for his role in Apocalypse's various genocides. So I can at least respect that.
I'd have to agree, but I always enjoy Cable. I mean, Deadpool just being an idiot.
but he's a good idiot in this one. He's kind of like when Cable's like, if he resurrects this time, I know I can save the world. And Deadpool's just like, yeah, that sounds good. So what do you want me to do, Nate? Like, he just reminds me of a lapdog.
I mean, it's funny in this one because, yeah, that's what he's acting like.
So who's your shittiest character?
Ozymandias. He's just there. Like he said, he doesn't shit. So it's like, why?
Yeah, true. And I completely agree with you. Except mine is Irene. Because
she can't do her job, clearly.
Yeah, every time. pretty much exactly. I mean, how are you a great reporter if every time you open your mouth it's either to state the obvious or demonstrate you don't fucking comprehend what's happening in front of you? She is the worst Lois Lane archetype, and she is, that's who she's supposed to be. Like she it's just honestly, it may, and you're not going to be surprised, but it makes me pine for Prester John and his completely phallic stellar rod. They would have been so much more useful.
You're pining for him. I'd rather you pine for Cyclops.
So yeah, next issue we're gonna get into a story where Deadpool is fomenting rebellion in a fictional state, and the Six Pack are back to once again do everything they can to fuck with Cable.
Oh, man, should be good.
So now, with Obi-Wan coming out and Star Wars being a little bit on people's minds, I took the time to read War of the Bounty Hunters and a few other Star Wars titles. War of the Bounty Hunters is basically, you know, Empire Strikes Back. Han Solo gets frozen in carbonite. In Return of the Jedi, it opens with them rescuing Han from Jabba's palace. But apparently Han's body had a lot of adventures in between getting from the Cloud City of Bespin to Jabba's palace on Tatooine. And in this case, in one storyline, he gets stolen from Boba Fett and taken it... It winds up as the centerpiece of a auction / gala that announces the return of the Crimson Dawn Syndicate, a criminal syndicate that in the extended Star Wars universe. So five takeaways from War of the Bounty Hunters and the related titles to this Marvel Comics event. First off, a lot of shit happens between the movies.
Yeah, I think people tend to forget that they really do space them out where there is a good gap of not months, but like, you know, several years. And yeah, a lot of shit can really be happening. Like, even as I was watching, I mean, I'll just reference back the Bad Batch, which is kind of like during the Clone Wars. Like, there's a lot that happens in there, just the different characters. And yeah, it's really cool. And there's different stories like, really make you appreciate like how they've been able to expand that Star Wars universe.
Oh yeah. And this one expands, like these storylines expand a lot of stuff. Like there's in the Darth Vader title, there's a kind of a trial by combat where basically the Emperor is like, I'm going to make you re-earn your place because I know you tried to betray me with your son, essentially. And you know, there's the Star Wars storyline where, you know, it's following the main characters, but it's following them in between the movies. And so, you know, before the iconic rescue where everyone remembers Leia for the, you know, bikini and whatnot, before that, there were failed attempts to rescue Han. There's also the bounty hunter storyline that, what's the guy's name? Valance is the main character of. And those are, you know, kind of fun. That one's kind of a good one. Yeah. So, you know, that's takeaway number one. A lot happens between the movies. Number two, it's nice to see flashbacks that show some of Han's Imperial times. Like I said, there's a bounty hunter, Braylor Valance, who is kind of like, if you've seen the prequel movies, General Grievous is actually an organic character that had sort of cyborg stuff grafted on top of him. That's why he has an actual heart for, I think it was to be burned when he's destroyed. You know, he's not actually a droid. He is a organic being.
Yeah.
That's also why he coughs, because, you know, he's not a droid. In this case, Braylor Valance was grievously injured and sort of left for dead, or at least determined to be useless to the Empire and sort of unceremoniously discharged. But before that, he was an Imperial fighter. And, you know, he's sort of like if you had a General Grievous where instead of preserving any kind of non-droid part, the only part that is preserved that is really organic anymore is like the face, the skin, you know, like everything else is consistently becoming more mechanical. But he looks relatively human. And his flashbacks when he's going towards into the War of the Bounty Hunters and trying to do what he can to acquire Han's body frozen in carbonite, it's established that like he has a noble reason for wanting to do it, because Han was always a nice person to him when they were both in the Imperials, you know, where people can be heartless and dickish because that's kind of rewarded. So like for Han to be a character with humanity, it kind of establishes why Han was willing to, you know, becomes this sort of smuggler with the heart of gold, and why he eventually joins the rebellion. So it's kind of cool to see his Imperial times, but also how those didn't really change him. And we knew about those Imperial times because of Solo. So
yeah.
So takeaway number three, speaking of Red Cup, Kira, which was played by Emilia Clarke, is the new head of the reconstituted Crimson Dawn Syndicate, which ties into the next major event after the war, Crimson Reign. If you remember, the way they left it was Kira wasn't really the head, but her boss wasn't really the head. The head of the Crimson Dawn at the end of Solo was Darth Maul. So either Kira is the new actual head, or she is just the head in public, and we're gonna see Darth Maul. I haven't read Crimson Reign yet because I'm waiting for it to come out. I don't like to read things in parts, but when it's fully out and on the app, it'll be interesting to see if Maul shows up.
Well, it should be really good. He's not one that was given too much. I mean, you've read more, but I'd like to know more on Maul and what was his culture.
Clone Wars. You got to look into Clone Wars. There's a whole storyline with him and his brother and the Sisters of Mercy or something like that.
Yeah.
All right, takeaway number four. Since these comics are set after Cloud City, but before the mission to rescue Han seen in Jedi, Luke needed to get a new lightsaber, because remember, his old one was sort of, you know, cut off and fell out of the garbage chute and kind of into the gas that is why Bespin is a Cloud City. So Luke needs a new lightsaber. He gets a yellow one, which he goes to a a Jedi temple and finds one that was kind of like the yellow ones used by the guards. So right now he's using a yellow lightsaber, and in these comics what that means is we will probably see him acquire another one, the green one that we see in Return of the Jedi, which will signal a shift in the comic narrative.
Yeah. Sorry, like that part I actually fully missed. I mean, remembering that, yeah, he loses it, but I mean, the fact that he actually ends up getting to take one of the special guards, yellow ones, which was very rare to ever see. And there's several videos and stories on that the yellow lightsaber was a rarity to see. So it was always intimidating, knowing that you were going to go against highly trained Jedi. But his transition to then green should be really good.
Yep. So takeaway number five, these comics are extremely fun reads. All right. But the method of connection between these comics and the War of the Bounty Hunters storyline proper leaves something to be desired. There's a couple of ways to do a crossover. One of which is kind of what we saw when House of M and Cable and Deadpool crossed over, where, you know, House of M affected Cable and Deadpool, but it was a self-contained storyline, so you could just read the Cable and Deadpool and just know that House of M happened to understand what was going on. Whereas with this one, it's one of those ones where there's a main title, but all the other titles are interrupted. So, like, as I was reading it, I didn't start with War of the Bounty Hunters. I started with Darth Vader. And when I got to a certain point, there were just disjointed issues where if you weren't reading the whole thing in order, you didn't have all the information once you started, and you had to kind of play inference catch up. And I kind of hate that method. If you want to have a special event, make the special event. If you want to have tie-ins, make the tie-ins, but don't make the tie-ins so reliant on the special event that it's got to, it's kind of a way to get you to pay for extra comics. And some of us don't really, in this time of inflation, some of us don't have that. So it just annoys me.
No, I'm with you. I'm the same. This time inflation is not easy on anybody at all.
Yeah. So, all right. We are a self-supported podcast. And with that, please spread the word any way you can. Help us out any way you can. We really appreciate it. Thank you for listening this far if you have. I'll let Verano have the last word.
We always try to pull out some new episodes as soon as possible. A little hard with both our lives, but we do the best we can. So please stay tuned and you'll hear from us very soon. Enjoy the summer.
See you. Bye.